Hello, welcome back to another Pole Position with You Got It, me and Joshua Zimmerman, because you are now listening to part two of our recording on Piłsudski. For those of you who have missed out on part one, make sure you head back and actually listen to it. But just in case you don't know who Joshua is an author and historian and also a professor of history at Yeshiva University. He's written books like Contested Memories, Poles and Jews During the Holocaust and Its Aftermath, The Polish Underground and the Jews, 1939 to 1945. And of course, his latest book, which is exactly what we've been talking about and exactly what we're going to be continuing in talking about, because where we left off in our last podcast, we actually were talking about Piłsudski, 1900, and his actual arrest. So he is carrying on with his clandestine activities. He has a newspaper with, what was it, 48 editions, Joshua?
Yeah, I forgot the about 48 editions when finally he is arrested and the printing press is confiscated by the Russian secret police in 1900.
Okay. This is important because he actually escapes, doesn't he? Problem here is he could end up either executed, God forbid, or back in exile or in Siberia.
Right. So this is a kind of moment in the book that could become like a kind of Hollywood remake of the life of Piłsudski, because we are speaking of a man after, you know, 6 years of being number one on the most wanted list in Russia. He's finally captured in the city of Łódź or Lodz in the western rim of Russia. The printing press is confiscated. And what they want to do is crush this underground party. And he's put into a high security prison, first in Warsaw. And he and his followers in the party are trying to come up with a scheme of how is it possible he can get out of this prison, because nobody knows what's going to be the sentence. When we think back, it's likely that he would have gotten a 10-year sentence of Siberian exile, probably not execution, probably not a death sentence, because he didn't conspire to assassinate a Russian official or, you know, assassinate the Tsar, for example, like those whom his brothers was associated with in 1887. So he probably would have gotten something like that, like 10 years exile. But the scheme they come up with, and these are the top members of the party, they start consulting with different specialists in the Polish community. And what they come up with is that it's impossible to escape from the high security prison in Warsaw. So the alternative plan is for Piłsudski to fake insanity, to get transferred to a mental hospital in St. Petersburg. It's really a place for basically prisoners who are considered to be insane or have, you know, it's called hospital for the mentally insane. And even though it has security, because these are people who've broken the law, they determined that that is a place where he could, from where he could escape. So it begins with, how is he going to fake insanity? And so what his comrades in the party, what they come up with is they consult a Polish psychiatrist to, first of all, advise on what are the symptoms of, you know, insanity? What would someone have to exhibit for you to determine and draw up a report to say, yes, he has gone insane and this is not a proper place for him. He should be transferred to this particular hospital. And now I give a photograph or kind of image in the book of that hospital. And somehow these secret notes are able to be delivered to Piłsudski in the prison. So he understands what's going on. He's given some instructions and he does begin to exhibit symptoms of, you know, mental illness and insanity enough. It is determined that he does need to be transferred. So he's arrested in February 1900, but in the end of 1900, he is transferred to that mental hospital in St. Petersburg. Now there, the party is able to concoct a scheme in which they are able to find a member of the party who's a student at St. Petersburg University. He's a medical student, and their scheme is to get him a job at the mental hospital and for him to carry out an escape. This one individual who is just graduating, so he's got this degree, a degree in psychiatry, by the way, that's his specialty, is able to get this position at the hospital. He's able to make contact with Piłsudski to let him know, you know, keep doing what you're doing. We're going to be coming up with a scheme. And this one gentleman is able to find a moment in time where most of the staff leave because it's an extended vacation. and there's a thinning out of security. And then he then orders that Pilsudski come to his office. He needs to examine him, and nobody's really suspicious. And in that examination room, he then switches and says, it's now. And he has a full regular, he says, take off, you know, your it's like a prison uniform. He has a new attire for him, a hat. And he goes, we're going to walk slowly and exit the hospital. There is a horse and buggy waiting for us. We will get on that horse and buggy and we have a safe house. And so this is how it's done. He actually accompanies this doctor. Pilsudski is now in a suit with a tie and a hat and looks like he's something that makes him appear to be an official of the hospital. And they exit. They get in this like droshky, a horse-driven, you know, buggy, and they're driven off to a safe house. And from there, that night, they get on a train to the Estonian region of Tsarist Russia. And then they go southward to different areas. And Pilsudski then reunites with his wife, because remember, he was married in 1899 to one member of his party. And she was arrested on that same day. They lived together as a married couple in February 1900. So she had been arrested, but she had already been freed. But then they conspired with her that she would reunite with her husband in this area of Ukraine near Kiev. And then they'd be transferred down to the border with Austria. And by the way, under hot pursuit, because when he escaped, the Russian police ordered all along the border with photographs that this man has to be apprehended. Somehow he and his wife, with a specialist to get them out of Russia, were able to accompany them to the south and find this one porous region of the border between Russia and Austria. And in something like March or April 1901, they crossed the border into Austria. And so that's the story of Pilsudski being freed. Now, nobody knows what's happening. And then he settles in Krakow. And it's only gradually that people in Austria, which is, when I say people, it had a Polish, of course, very established Polish community. Of course, Krakow has a Polish majority, but there's also a strong Polish Social Democratic Party there as well. And he establishes himself there with his wife and his stepdaughter. And from that moment on, from late 1901, 1902, until the beginning of World War I, he lives in this kind of free constitutional Austria, and for the first time can operate openly under his real name and write and publish under his real name. So it's an extraordinary 12-year period, the first time he lives in a constitutional state with freedom of press, freedom of speech. The Polish socialists have members in the parliament. They have their own press. It's legal and open. And in addition, he's not living in Paris. He's living in Krakow, you know, which was the medieval capital of Poland and has a Polish majority. It's dominated by Polish culture. So it's really an extraordinary time for him to experience a kind of democratic culture. And anyone who today goes to Krakow, you can actually visit where he and his wife first took up residence in Krakow. There's a plaque there. They moved a couple times, but that was his home.
I'm quite interested. There's so much we could talk about in this time period, but we're going to skip because I want people to actually go out and read the book rather than us talk about the whole book in detail.
Okay,
but
sure.
But 1904 and 1905, very big years for Pilsudski. And especially things are happening around the world as well. The world's getting a bit shook up in 1904. So tell us what happens in those 2 years that could possibly change things for him.
So this is actually a critical milestone moment in the biography of Pilsudski because of the following. So the Russians enter a war with Japan in 1904 called the Russo-Japanese War. So it kind of opens up these possibilities for Poles, which is that the country that has occupied their lands, Tsars, is at full-scale war with Japan. So Pilsudski is actually dispatched by his party to Tokyo, and he travels to Tokyo with some of his comrades to try to meet with members of the Japanese government, with the top people in the Japanese military, and to try to maybe sign an agreement with them in which they could get the Poles, the Polish Socialist Party, which would proposed that if they could get military aid from the Japanese to expand and create a kind of Polish paramilitary organization. In exchange, the Poles would give military information to the Japanese, something like giving them stats on movement of Russian troops and vital kind of military intelligence, but they'd want a kind of Japanese support of the Poles and eventually a kind of armed rising. The idea was that as the war between Russia and Japan gets more severe and more Russian troops are dispatched to the east, the Poles could kind of ally with Japan and kind of rise up on the Western periphery and seize independence in some kind of cooperation with Japan. Now, the proposal was rejected and Pilsudski returns. The Japanese did give some kind of monetary aid to the Polish Socialist Party because they had shared objectives, which is the defeat of Russia. But it is said that the impact of that on Pilsudski was profound because meeting with these top generals of the Japanese army, he began kind of realization or kind of current of thought that perhaps the entire Polish romantic insurrectionary tradition, the uprising of 1863, the one of 1830, General Kosciuszko's uprising of 1794, all of which have failed, maybe this is has to be completely replaced, that method of bringing about the aim of independence, with the idea of the military solution. And that is, he started realizing that the only thing that's going to expel Russian forces from Polish lands is a conflict between Russia and other great powers in Europe, like Austria and Germany. The Poles themselves, simply in terms of numbers, cannot physically expel the Russians from Polish lands. It has to be that a Austro-German armed force in a war with Russia would expel. So he starts thinking about this and starts really focusing on the military. And what is our evidence for that? He comes back from Japan in October 1904. And 1 month later, he finds himself back and he infiltrates back into Russia. He forms something called the Combat Organization of his party. It was the first military wing. And in the same month as he forms the first military wing, he calls on the first armed action in Warsaw against Russian police and soldiers in Grzybowski Square. And the importance of that is that essentially there was a kind of demonstration in which the Russian gendarmes started surrounding with Cossacks coming. And in the middle of that crowd, there were armed men of the Polish Socialist Party who then opened fire against the Russian troops, and they withdrew, and there was gunfire, and there were casualties and deaths, but it was reported in the London Times and in the New York Times that this armed action had taken place, and they noted that it was the first Polish armed action against Russians since 1863. And for Pilsudski, this had a profound symbolic meaning that we've now, that he's pioneered the revival of a kind of the nucleus of some kind of military organization. And he saw it as the nucleus. I only just want to say one other thing is that if we go like 1 year later at the height of the 1905 revolution in Russia, we have this one recollection of a close comrade of Pilsudski who visited him in Krakow. And what he was surprised at is that Pilsudski, who normally would be thrilled to see that there's now a huge Russian rising among the labor classes against, there's a revolution going on in Russia. And it's the high point of the Russian labor movement. And Russia just issued a manifesto for democracy. And this is, you'd think Pilsudski would be overjoyed at this. But this comrade wrote in his memoirs that what struck him is that Pilsudski was completely disinterested in what was going on. He was quiet and then changed the subject abruptly. And all he talked about was military history and the formation of a Polish armed force that could expel Russia from Polish land. So suddenly his focus became totally on the military. And listeners should know that from that time on till the start of World War I in 1914. So what does he do? He forms the Union of Active Struggle in 1908. In 1910, he forms the Riflemen's Association. He starts to have training courses for Polish officers in Austria. And he he works with the Austro-Hungarian government and their military to get legalization of the Polish paramilitary forces.
On. He's creating paramilitary organizations.
Yeah.
But how is he funding all of this? Because it's not like he magics money from anywhere, from nowhere. He's got to get the money from somewhere.
Yeah. So that's an excellent question. What I found is that because he was a pragmatist, the moment he founded the combat organization, he also said we need what we call a treasury department, which is collection of funds in order to purchase arms, to purchase, to pay instructors and so forth. Where that came from, I didn't follow many trails, but essentially they were like wealthy landowners who sympathized with the idea. And then they had Austrian military support. So they actually, the high command of the Austrian armed forces now had direct line with Pilsudski and gave their approval to this group, which for listeners to know, conflict between Austria and Russia was increasing, and it was likely that there'd be an armed conflict. So Austria now acknowledged that these Polish forces could help them in a war with Russia. So they were actually starting to give support to the paramilitary forces. But I haven't tracked down where all the funding came from.
Let's talk a bit more about these paramilitary organizations, only because I'm going to be really selfish. So my great-grandfather was part of these paramilitary organizations.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, the general in the Second World War. But at the time, he was a young man. I think he was about 17 years old. And he joins the organization in 1912. And he's one of the first organizational guys in there. Gets his code name, is ready to rock and roll. They were in Tarnów at the time. So, you know, that whole area is becoming rife with these organizations. And he writes a little bit about how they would go to school and then in the afternoons they do their training or the weekends or the evenings. And I mean, he's a 17-year-old kid who's been, not that I'm saying dragged, because these kids are inspired, like Pilsudski was when he was a child, by their parents. They're taught Polish. They continue reading, writing, and learning about the uprising insurgents and everything else. And they're adamant on fighting. I mean, it's incredible to watch how many of these young kids actually join these organizations. It's unbelievable.
Just curious. Did your father write, your great-grandfather, did he write recollections?
No.
Or is these stories that came down through the
These are stories that have come down, but for example, he's more World War II. He's written down his World War II experiences rather than his First World War, which is a really big shame because that would have been really interesting. But at the time, it's the same as, for example, you meet World War II veterans. It was like, yeah, I was in the uprising and that's about it. And there's nothing, you know, they don't think it's important or exciting or interesting for historians in the future.
You're so right about that. Well, going back to your great-grandfather in 1912. So by 1912, you now have these established paramilitary organizations essentially in Kraków and Lviv in Western and Eastern Galicia. Pilsudski commanded the Kraków one, and then His comrade, Kazimierz Sosnkowski, was instrumental in the Lviv chapter, if I'm correct about that. And these paramilitary groups grew to, by the eve of World War I, about 7,500 soldiers. And we should note how central this was in kind of shaping a Polish national mindset, preparing for the liberation of Poland. But why were they drawn to Pilsudski so much? Because I believe it was the combination of the national and the democratic ideal. Because remember that Pilsudski included non-Poles in these paramilitary organizations, so Jews, Ukrainians, and women. And so I was struck by reading Alexandra Szczerbinska's memoirs. She became Alexandra Pilsudska, Pilsudski's second wife, but she was at this time a member of the combat organization, and she was in Lviv and Kraków, and she was one of the leaders of the women's division of the combat organization. So to me, that's extraordinary, not just, you know, that there was these paramilitary, but they included women, and that factor, I believe, really shaped Pilsudski's kind of like what today we would call feminist proclivities, because he was instrumental when Poland became a state in 1918 in imposing in the first electoral law the right of women to vote. On November 28, 1918, it's the first electoral law of reborn Poland. And against the advice of many of his top advisors, who were at the time believed that Polish women tended to vote conservatively, they tended to be more vulnerable to the views of the Catholic Church, his argument why it must be that women have the right to vote in Poland. And by the way, it made Poland the fourth country in the Western world, long before the US, long before France, long before UK. His argument was that back during the period of the Riflemen's associations, women had a combat unit. And in World War I, in the legions, there was a women's division. He's like, how is it possible that you can tell women who literally put their lives on the line for Poland that they were not ready to give you the right to vote? That was his argument.
And, I love it. You can give up your life, but you can't vote.
But you can't vote. I mean, what's interesting is even on the left, we're talking about his socialist comrades are saying, this is not going to go well for us. We should wait on women. Let's wait and discuss this later. Now it'll just be men and later women, maybe in 5 years. But we're afraid that giving women the right to vote will skew the electorate towards your opponents, who are the National Democrats.
But he it's funny because a lot of his cabinet were women in the end. He had a lot of women advisors. I mean, it's incredible to the amount he's literally surrounded himself with. I mean, we all know he was a bit of a ladies' man, but yeah, at the end of the day,
that's true.
He still surrounded himself, and he surrounded himself by really smart women. For example, if I'm not mistaken, one of the women in his advisories, something along those lines, she was actually a soldier. She dressed up as a man. And she fought in the Polish legions as a man.
Oh, wow.
And it's just incredible. These women.
That's fascinating. I didn't know about that.
There we go. I actually wrote an article about her.
I'd love to know that person's name and the different things surrounding. But even the idea that not during, but even before World War I, that there's a woman's. And I think it has something to do with Alexandra Shcherbinska, who, like I mentioned, becomes his second wife and the mother of his two daughters later on, because she wrote these incredible memoirs that comes out in 1941, which is, you know, almost wraps it in more mystery. And just that these memoirs come out, you know, Poland, Pilsudski's already perished, Poland is collapsed, and she's in exile in London and puts out these memoirs called Pilsudski, a biography by his wife. And she recounts in those her own for listeners, she was a member of the Polish Socialist Party, and they first met in 1906. She was the leader of the munitions division of the combat organization, in which she gathered purchases. First of all, it was gathering the funds, then purchasing munitions, having them stored in secret places, and then distributing them from Warsaw to the provinces. That's how she first met Pilsudski, because he was the leader of the party and she was in that role, and then later would become part of the women's division of the Riflemen, 1912 to 1914, then in part of the legions. You know, so there really is a kind of, what we call that, a very kind of open, pluralistic ideal, which I believe is what drew a lot of Polish Jews to Pilsudski, because in World War I, we believe that approximately 10% of the legions were Poles of Jewish background or Polish Jews.
Let's stick with this, actually, because it is fascinating. He has a very interesting relationship with Polish Jews, we could say that. I mean, some of his manifestos, for example, he was actually, he used not very nice Polish words. I think if I'm not mistaken, one of them was it Żydek used? Yes.
Żydkowia, Żydek. I bring this out in the book.
It's quite interesting because he uses this not accepted and middle class sort of, for him, I guess it's normal, is it?
So in my first article about Pilsudski, which I ever wrote, it was in 1998. It was called Joseph Pilsudski and the Jewish Question, 1893. to 1905. I bring this out that in his correspondence, and these are private, in public, he uses the proper term. In public, I mean in speech and in his articles, which is Jews, Jewish people, and so forth. But in private correspondence, he descends into these pejorative terms, which are hard to kind of translate into English, but I think it's something like little Jews. Maybe if you say Jiddik instead of Jid, it's more like that little Jew.
I think the best way to, I think it's probably like, I apologize for using this, but for example, Jew boy.
Right. That could be one of them. Although I've spent a lot of time looking into this, and there's literally one amazing article in Poline, a journal of Polish Jewish studies, which found, it did an analysis of the word in Polish and found that there was about 81 variants in Polish of this. This scholar is a linguist and went into it. There's all different variations. And when I asked my mentor in Polish Jewish history what he thought, he believed that that Jew boy doesn't really capture it. That's stronger than Jidek. It really more means the little Jew. So it'd be like, there's another way to be very pejorative, but it is demeaning. But what I found is that he used it only to refer to Jews that were his opponents, but he never used it for Polish Jews who were members of the party or kind of, I guess he agreed with him. But it was these particular figures who were openly in debate with him in essentially in print, and he resented them. And so he did use that language, it's true. I remember, I just want to share this, that it's a long time ago, but the first time I ever gave a paper at a conference, it just happened to be that the late Piotr Vondich from Yale, who's like the most prominent scholar of Poland in the United States, happened to be a discussant on that panel. This would be in 1996. It was the first time I was in graduate school. It was the first time I'd ever given it. It was on this subject of Pilsudski, and I mentioned those terms. And I did not anticipate that he would get quite annoyed with that. And he thought it was distorting his, I think his perception is by putting that out in public, it's kind of distorting Pilsudski's attitude to the Jews, that it's suggesting he had a prejudice, but that really he didn't. And it really offended him. I think it's important to lay out everything we know and then make an evaluation.
Well, you know, Piłsudski had, what you said, 10% in his...
10% of the is what we found in the legions in Austria, descending from Austria and Galicia, yeah.
That's incredible, including how many Jews he pulled into the party, he pushed for them to fight for Polish independence, and how many of them truly were real fighters for the independence of Poland, you know, and how many he worked with, and Jews that he met in exile and everything else, and the policies he tried to push for post-war, and all sorts of, you know, these various, could you really say, we can't taint people with the modern day anti-Semitic or non-anti-Semitic brush at the end of the day. We're talking about life was different at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yes, I think that's very fair. I mean, my father has often said to me, who is a retired history teacher of American history, often said to me, like in the year 1918 in America, he said, what percentage of Americans do you think were not anti-Semitic? And he said probably like 2% were not, meaning what he thought is, and it would not surprise him because that was kind of common at the time. He thinks it was just very common to have these prejudices and to project backward our views today. Can we really criticize now? It's different if someone's proposing a policy to limit the rights of a minority. And that's something that Pilsudski never did because he believed that legal discrimination against a minority was a threat to the democratic ideal. And he just simply would never tolerate that. And I think that's one of the takeaways about Pilsudski, that if we say that he was a maverick and he kind of went against the trends of his time. So you can say as he's leading this state with Europe's largest Jewish community and the world's second largest, right? One in every three European Jews lives within the boundaries of Poland. And we have rising fascism in Italy, the rise of Nazi Germany, we have the crimes committed against Jews in Soviet Russia at the time in 1936, 1937. And Pilsudski regarded all that as central threats to democracy, which is at that moment that you begin to take away the universal principle of law that should apply to everyone, then you're going to see the disintegration of that democratic state. And that's why it seems to be a consensus that while Pilsudski was living, this consensus is that he wouldn't allow these kinds of excesses against minorities. But I didn't mean to get to the 1930s. If we
that's
go back
okay.
just to the legions, I want to say in my book, I have a photograph of someone named Bronislav Manspearl, who was an officer, a Jewish officer in Pilsudski's legions, and he perished on the battlefield in 1915 in a fight with the Russian armed forces. And I put that in the book because that figure himself became symbolic later to Polish Jews about the Jewish participation in the struggle for Poland. So much so that in 1931, the famous Polish Jewish artist, Arthur Schick, he came out with this collection of 44 paintings, and he called it the Statute of Kalisz. And it was essentially paintings from the beginnings of the history of Poland to the present of moments of what he called Polish Jewish brotherhood. In other words, moments in which Jews were participating in the struggle for Polish sovereignty. And in that book, he has a painting of Bronislav Manspearl as a symbol. And then the book itself is dedicated to Józef Pilsudski. And I thought that was important, that if you look at that dedication page from a Polish Jewish artist, that he's devoting this almost like his life's work, because it was 44 major works of art that he had done in 1931. Why is he devoting it to Józef Pilsudski, a book about this subject? Because he believes that he is an outcome of this long history of the Jewish struggle with Poles for sovereignty.
I mean, it's interesting. We've covered, we're bouncing around a little bit, which is
yeah.
Which is
I'm sorry
fine.
That we bounced no? around. We can actually. I like that we were back in 1912, 1913, and with your great grandfather. I think that's a really critical thing. Your great grandfather must have revered Pilsudski. Am I right?
He did. If you actually go into Szukaj w archiwach, so search the archives, the Polish webpage, and you search for General Władysław Langner, you'll actually find a picture of him and Pilsudski in 1934 in Warsaw, which is really interesting. I mean, my great-grandfather, his career was made by Pilsudski, first brigade. He was a platoon leader. He fought in the 1920 war. He rose up through the ranks very, 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 very quickly. He's one of, I think, the youngest generals ever in Polish history. It's just incredible. I mean, this man's career was made by Pilsudski, and that's who he's got to thank for at the end of the day.
I wonder where this fanatical loyalty came from. because maybe your great-grandfather shared in that there was a sense, maybe because there was a sense that he really acted for the greater good, and that there was a trust in him that he would not veer into currents and paths that in any way compromise the interest of the state. So somehow people had this trust in him about that he wouldn't, he wouldn't be, working with another country that in any way threatened the sovereignty of Poland or threatened Poland's interest for personal gain.
It's very interesting because if we skip again, jumping a couple of 10 years into the future, but if you look at the Second World War, being a supporter of Pilsudski in the Polish army in exile is not a good thing. It is really not a good thing. So, because then we've spoken about some of the people, Sosnkowski, for example, pro Pilsudski. We haven't talked about Domowski yet, who I think is a total asswipe. Sorry for being so blunt, but he is. And then we haven't even touched about Sikorsky, and he mm-hmm. despises people that were, as you could say, in the Piłsudski camp. Rather, you know, you have this, which we're going to talk about in a bit, you're going to have this division between Piłsudski and Dmowski, and it just becomes just so political. And Piłsudski is still, years later, he's being talked about, even though, you know, he doesn't get talked about in the communist period, you know, it's a bit different. And he's for God's sakes, you go around Warsaw, how many statues have you got of Piłsudski? You will go to any town, any city in Poland. The two most common statues you will find anywhere in Poland are Piłsudski and John Paul II.
Uh-huh. Isn't this interesting? I mentioned in my introduction that one of the first acts of the post-communist Polish government in 1990 was to rename the square in Warsaw as Piłsudski Square in the center of Warsaw, and then a few years later unveil the first statue to Piłsudski in Warsaw in 1995 in Piłsudski Square, and then 3 years later a second statue at the Belvedere Palace. And then I just list all the towns and cities in Poland that erected Piłsudski statues since the fall of communism. And to me, it's very telling that one of the first things that the Red Army did in 1940, when they captured Vilna, they annexed Lithuania, is they knocked down Piłsudski statues. So wherever the Soviets went, they toppled Piłsudski statues. So it's something, you know, to think about. The re-erection of these statues was supposed to be very symbolic, but you're right. It's all over Poland. I once did something that I think listeners will understand, which is I went on Google Maps and I went into Poland and I just wrote in Piłsudski. And then I was kind of startled by all these dots that went down, which is, it's almost like it didn't know how to react because there were so many red dots to go. Well, Piłsudski Street here and then statue here, but it was all over the country. And so what does that mean? Like, and to me, it means that he's the George Washington of Poland. He's the repository of all Polish ideals and aspirations. And I shouldn't say all Poles, but let's say for a kind of majority in the way that they envision the future of Poland. One thing I bring out is that whereas Piłsudski used to be a very divisive figure, he was demonized in communist Poland, called a fascist and an enemy of progress. Today in Poland, both the left and right embrace Piłsudski. But what you'll see is that the right leaves out the part of his legacy about advocacy for minority rights and pluralism. And the left leaves out the parts of what I call the dark legend of Piłsudski, which we can get to later. And that is the coup d'etat, the kind of like authoritarian turn that happens in his later years. So we have kind of incomplete pictures, but it is a new era when both left and right in Poland embrace. And I only want to just say for listeners that it's very startling to go back to the 1970s, 1980s and read how just the Polish community around in Poland and then the Polish diaspora, you can call it, in England, in Australia, in the United States, how Piłsudski was viewed. And we had what in communist Poland, the demonization of Piłsudski, because remember he was staunchly anti-Soviet and they distorted fundamentally his view and tried to write him out of the historical record. It's almost like they tried to banish him. So he's demonized there. And in the West in general, Polish Americans and also in Great Britain and also some non-Polish scholars like Norman Davies in England, you know, promoted a very positive image of Piłsudski. But then what I found is that in the 1970s and 1980s, there were followers of Roman Dmowski, so who led the National Democrats.
Horrible person.
Who before World War II was Piłsudski's greatest opponent, right? And what I found there is that there were some works in Polish that were still arguing that Piłsudski was an enemy of Poland, but it even went farther. So it's just surprising to read this. It happens to be someone named Jędrzej Giertych, who was a follower of Dmowski, and actually the publisher of this book in London said the Roman Dmowski Society. And
oh my God, sorry.
3-volume biography of Pilsudski. It's so bizarre for me to read this. 3 volumes. And all it is Joseph Pilsudski, 1914 to 1921. It's not even his whole life. But in there, he says Pilsudski was neither a Pole nor a Catholic, and he was an enemy of Poland and an enemy of the Polish people.
Yes, the man who...
The main claim is that he wasn't Polish and he wasn't Catholic. He was Lithuanian and he was Protestant.
God, I love this.
It's unnerving the way... And they said he was a Bolshevik radical socialist who, you know, who did horrible things for Poland. And I'm just reading this and just wondering what Polish person in 1980, 81 in London or in Chicago was reading this and going, oh yeah, this makes a lot of sense to me.
I could imagine my father, he took part in loads of these, you know, anti-Soviet marches and pro-Solidarność stuff back in the day. I could just imagine him reading that and just throwing it down the toilet.
Right. It was, I mean, I think it's the people who are Pilsudski opponents, I realize it's obsessional. So when I looked at this author, Jędrzej Gierte, by the way, his grandson is in the Polish parliament today. But Jędrzej Gierte, I looked and in the bibliography, which is to me just almost laughable, it's really just a bibliography of his own writings. And he listed like 84 writings on Pilsudski by himself. And they're like little articles here and there. So somehow, I'm not sure why Pilsudski inspired such hatred by his opponents. In that sense, like who was this guy writing 90 something articles and a 3-volume, I mean, this is a pretty massive 3-volume history of Pilsudski in just, you know, like a 7-year period, and is a tirade against him.
It's an obsession. I mean, this kind of sounds fun. I'm going to get obsessive over a historical figure, write about 100 articles and then slam them in because I said that they were a horrible person and therefore quote myself. And then make that sound like it's primary source material. I think that kind of sounds like fun.
Yeah, it didn't, you know, it does. There's very few footnotes or anything, but it is just a continuation of that pre-World War II argument between Pilsudski's camp and then his opponents on the right. Today we'd call them populists, but Roman Dmowskis. But I really want to go back to World War I. I didn't mean to.
That's okay.
To depart from World War I.
We will come back to World War I, but do you know what? We're going to have to cut this one off. We're going to have to do a third parter. Oh, no, everyone. You're going to have to listen to a third part. I'm sorry. I lied to you all. It's not a 2-parter. It could be a 3 or a 4 or a 5-parter because we have so much to say, so much to discuss, because we're covering such a wide time period that there is so much that goes on. We have to talk about everything.
Well, I would be very pleased to do a third part then.
Perfect. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. We will see you on our third part. And thank you to Josh again for joining us. And hopefully we'll keep your interested sort of peak going.
Thank you so much.